It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we take stock of the progressive movement in Wisconsin 5 years after Act 10. 5 years ago, when the Budget Repair Bill, or Act 10, was being voted on, the progressive presence in Wisconsin, especially in Madison, was hard to miss.
Tens of thousands of protesters gathered on the steps of the Capitol. That iconic symbol of the blue fist was plastered around Madison and elsewhere in 2011, opposing changes brought by Act 10 that would affect collective bargaining and public sector employees. But that wave of progressive fervor didn't necessarily translate into election wins and recall campaigns and beyond.
Our next guest, Dee Hall, is managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She wrote a recent piece for Madison Magazine called What's Happened to Progressivism? Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, first off, the word progressive is one that's been used a fair bit this year, especially with Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton debating its meaning. How are we defining what a progressive is right now?
Well, I think that is part of the issue that's facing this movement. There are people who are in the movement but disagree on what it means. There are people who call themselves progressive, such as Mayor Paul Soglin here in Madison, but others would say he's not progressive. And so I think that is part of the problem that the movement is facing right now.
And would you say that during Act 10, when there were those tens of thousands of protesters, that that could fairly be called a progressive protest movement going on?
I think it was definitely a high point for the progressive movement here in Wisconsin, that more energy there than we had seen in many, many years. So, yes, in that case, they were standing up for the rights of unionized workers, standing up for, you know, there were some other issues that were thrown in there at the same time, you know, Medicaid funding and things of that nature, you know, funding education, teachers and their rights and responsibilities. And so it was a big moment, but it just didn't result in the wins that they were aiming for.
And these days, do we have a sense about how many people identify with progressive politics in Wisconsin?
It's not a lot of people. It's less than you might imagine. Right now, as of 2012, the Marquette Law School poll asked that question. The last time they asked it was 2012, and they found 19% of Wisconsinites identifying themselves as progressives or liberals. Nationwide, it was even less than that in 2010. It was more like 12%. And then in that same poll in 2010, that national poll, more than half of the people said they actually don't really know what progressivism is. They could not define it.
Well, looking at what happened here in Wisconsin, people in 2011, progressives thought they were on the road to victory at the time. There were petitions signed to recall Governor Scott Walker. Then he was reelected three times. What happened?
Well, there are a couple things going on there. I talked with Kathy Kramer, who in the Department of Political Science here in Madison. She went around the state talking to people about their political beliefs, and she discovered there's a big divide. It's primarily an urban-rural divide, but it divides a lot of people who feel like they're not getting from the government what they want or need. And so as a matter of fact, they just don't support the government. Progressives have sort of the opposite idea. They feel like the government is the great problem solver. It is the great provider. And so, you know, you've got that divide there. And I think that's what was going on, is essentially there were enough people who really still feel that the government is more of a problem than a solution. And those people voted for Governor Walker. In addition, there was the issue that the unions that traditionally support liberals and progressives were severely weakened by that Act 10. And they were traditionally one of the biggest supporters of these candidates, and their power was severely diminished as a result of that legislation.
What kind of overlap is there, do you think, at least as it's seen by the banner holders of the progressive movement, what kind of overlap do they see between rural voters and a possible progressive agenda?
Well, there are some folks. I talked with Matt Rothschild, who was the editor of the Progressive magazine for over 30 years, and he now works for the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. His idea was that actually a lot of people, if you just ask them, if you take away the label of progressive and you just ask them whether they support certain initiatives, they would fall on the pretty progressive. Uniform background, universal background checks for guns, more family leave, some other issues that progressives would and do push that people who might even call themselves Republicans or conservatives would actually be in favor of.
Do you have a sense of whether Wisconsin is in new territory in terms of maybe losing some of its progressive fervor, given its history, the birthplace of the progressive movement?
Well, it certainly has less influence than it used to have. There's no question about that. Wisconsin used to be sort of on the vanguard of a lot of social service and safety net type programs like workers' compensation and things of that nature. We have seen a pullback on a lot of those programs over the last several years, particularly under Governor Walker.
And going forward, I mean, you gathered a lot of opinions about this. What did those banner holders of the progressive movement, what did they say about the health of the progressive movement and where it stands today?
I think there was among the folks that I talked to, there was a sense that there needs to be more outreach to people who wouldn't even necessarily ever call themselves progressive. But if you can talk to them about the sort of things that progressives believe in, that there might be a chance to bring them on board.
We're talking with Dee Hall right now, managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about her recent article called What's Happened to Progressivism.
And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think progressivism, the progressive movement, has declined in Wisconsin? Is the political right serving the state better, reaching out to people better? And what does the future hold? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation with Dee Hall, the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about her recent piece, Taking Stock of Progressive Politics in Wisconsin 5 years after Act 10 was passed.
We want to hear from you. Do you think that progressive politics are as influential as they used to be in the state? Did you leave one side, go to the other? Do you think that the state has changed forever? Or is this a pendulum that's got to swing back? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Jody on the line with us in Oconomowoc. Jody, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The point that I wanted to make, I am a progressive. I will always be a progressive as far as I know. And after the recall attempt of Governor Walker, those of us who signed the recall petition, our names were all put on a registry collected by Walker supporters, and it was put to on a website, which still may exist, called Put Wisconsin First. And this is a website people could check to see if we recall, if we signed the recall. And added to that, our addresses, our locations, geopositionings of our home, and also exact photographed copies of the recall petitions were on this website. And the website was also connected to the state website, which included information about tax delinquents, sex offenders, and criminals.
So, Jody, we're going to leave it there. I want to make sure we can get Dee in on this and get some callers in, too. Thank you for that. Did that come up at all? Did you sense that there was any backlash, I guess, against people who identified as progressives in Wisconsin, something like she was mentioning there?
Well, I think I can't speak to that particular website. I'm not familiar with it, but I will say that obviously the political divides that exist in Wisconsin were just on complete display during those Act 10 protests. And I believe a lot of that divide continues to exist. And a lot of it has to do with the complete difference of opinion between what role government should play, whether it should be a protector and a provider, or whether it should simply get out of the way and be a minimal influence on daily life.
Jody, thank you for that. And do you want to ask you about something that came up on our Facebook page when people were talking about the possible decline of progressivism in Wisconsin? Some people brought up the redrawing of district lines for voting districts. Did you look at that?
Yeah, I did look at that. Now, so in the 2012 election, the Democrats actually got more votes for assembly members, if you look at the state as a whole, but the Republicans retained 60 of the 99 seats, and so they're firmly in charge in the legislature. A lot of people say that is because of the redistricting that was handled by Republicans back after the last census. And so they have a structural, they meaning Republicans, have a structural advantage right now that is pretty hard to counteract. And, you know, Democrats, if they ever get in charge, will have the opportunity to have a more nonpartisan redistricting. But they did not take advantage of that in the past when they were in charge.
Jody, thanks for the call. We're going to go next to Jeff joining us in Eau Claire. Jeff, hi.
Hello. Thanks for hosting this conversation.
You're welcome. What did you want to bring up?
Well, my life is kind of an anecdote of this movement that was launched. When the protest started, I had just graduated from college and was living in Madison and working three jobs. And I was inspired to become a teacher, and I'm now a history teacher. I went back to school for a few years, and I'm now kind of living sort of the reality of the changes made to education and the working conditions of teachers. But I feel like I have learned a lot over the past few years, and I think that the same sort of strategies that have been used over the past few years have failed. And I think that looking forward, we need a different sort of politics. And I think the beginning of the conversation was really helpful that sometimes the word progressive can be really ambiguous. But if we think in terms of class politics and where power lies, I think that the debate can really be clarified in a way that Republicans and Democrats alike can kind of muddy the water and not really allow people to see where things lie in terms of what is good for the majority, the public good, and who's actually making the wealth that gives the Koch brothers the ability to spend all these millions and billions to influence our government.
Jeff, thank you for that call and for sharing your story. Jeff's got an interesting story there going back to the protests and, you know, lots of different ways we could respond to that call. But do you think that there is something that progressives are looking at rebooting what it means to be a progressive? I know you talked to Mike McCabe a little bit about this.
Right. He's running Blue Jean Nation, which is, he describes it as a political party for the politically homeless. He told Democrats and progressives gathered on campus last fall that essentially they need to craft an optimistic vision for the future and not focus so much on past gains that they've made with Social Security and some other big social programs.
And looking again, you know, expressly at progressive politics in Wisconsin, are there names right now that are carrying that mantle forward?
So names of
politicians, activists.
Well, of course, we have on the national level. You have Hillary Clinton talking with Bernie Sanders about what it means to be a progressive, and at this moment, because they're playing to the base, both of them want to be seen as more progressive than the other. So I would say that has raised the issue of what a progressive is and who a progressive is on a national level to a degree that we have not seen in a long time.
And anybody here in the state particularly?
Well, Russ Feingold, of course, ran Progressives United, and he's running to try to regain his seat from 6 years ago from conservative businessman Ron Johnson.
And we leave it there. Dee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That was Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her recent piece in Madison Magazine is called What's Happened to Progressivism? And we've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Not too many years ago, if you wanted to listen to music that had been maybe released 20 years ago on a small label or on a decaying medium, you had to really want it. You had to go to old music stores or maybe connect with specialty dealers.
All that's changed today in the era of digital music with outlets like Spotify, Pandora, iTunes, YouTube making huge stashes of music available with just a couple of clicks. Our next guest calls it the age of musical plenty. It's a time when the sheer volume of available music can be paralyzing.
And his new book, Ben Ratliff, lays out some new ways to be a better listener in a saturated musical world. His book is called Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot.
Well, how would you describe this new era of musical plenty?
Well, it's just the phenomenon of having everything in your pocket, you know? It's instant access to what seems like every song ever. The name of the book is Every Song Ever, but of course we don't have every song ever. There's lots of important music that was never recorded, and there's lots of recorded music still that has not been properly negotiated for or whatever, and you just can't find online or through streaming services. But, I mean, I'm a music critic for the New York Times. I use streaming services every day. It's an amazing resource. I'm always astonished at the depth of what's out there. But I guess, you know, once in a while in your life, you encounter something that you like and you don't like in equal measure. And that's sort of my feeling about streaming services right now.
And Ben, I think I'm probably not alone. I've been in that position where I pick up my phone or I'm on my computer and think, okay, I can listen to anything I want to. And then I'm paralyzed by choice. I don't even know where to start. And that's kind of what you're tackling here in the book, sort of mental organizing principles to help us decide what to listen to next.
There is an idea out there that you know, abundance is paralyzing, and that it feels bad. You know, that it's a problem. I don't really feel that way myself. I think actually it's a good moment, and we have to mark this moment and say, you know, it was never like this before. I think actually it's the streaming services who are partially telling us that it's that, you know, all that choice is paralyzing because they want to make it easier for you. That's their business. So I write just a little bit in the book about algorithms and you know, how streaming services feed you music, how they size you up as a listener, or kind of define the type of music that you seem to like, and they're going to want to give you that more or less, a larger version of your comfort zone, so that you will discover new things. You know, nobody can say that you'll be hearing the same five records over and over again, but it'll be more or less in tune with what you already know. And my book is an argument against that spirit, because I feel that the listener is really powerful now in a new way. Because of access. Access is power. And so we've got all this stuff. What are we going to do with it?
Well, I want to dig into some of the new ways that you suggest we can start listening and be better listeners to the music that's out there. And you're saying just sort of throw out the genres, the way we've been thinking about it, the sort of niche listening that people do. And one of the new ways you're suggesting is to listen for slowness. And it sounds like you've actually been slowing down songs to see how they hold up. What have you found about this sort of slow, I guess, kind of a groove that songs can have?
Sure. Well, the book is broken down into chapters about different kinds of listening experiences. And this is how I'm dividing up music in the book. It's a suggestion for you know, different ways other than genre to listen. And one of the chapters, as you say, is about slowness. And it's about what is it like to listen to music that's slower than it needs to be? What's the effect of that, of radically slow tempos? And how, you know, how can it, it's a way of connecting far apart kinds of music. If you like the way Sarah Vaughan sings a very slow ballad, you might also be interested in, you know, Shostakovich's Last String Quartet, which also has a very deep slowness to it. Slowness in particular is sort of amazing, I think, in music, because it intensifies whatever is already there when you bring the tempo down. And if a song is really strong, if it's strong enough to handle a radically slow tempo, it can be an amazing experience.
Well, let's give a listen to you recommend for each of your organizing principles a bunch of different songs. Here's one from the slow chapter, Richie Valens and Donna. Here it is.
Richie Valens song Donna, there, kind of aggressively slow, but kind of hypnotic too.
But it's funny that you chose that one because that is a beautiful ballad with a cool slow tempo. But I brought that one up in the book specifically because a friend of mine long ago was experimenting with taking 45 RPM records and playing them on 33, and you know, this is back in a long time ago, he was doing this on a cassette. So he recorded maybe 10 of these in a row, and he got very scientific about it. You know, some songs work when you slow them, when you play them at the wrong speed, and some don't. And that was one that worked. When you played that one even slower, at, you know, the 45 single of it on 33, it held together and it intensified. And the emotions that are already there grew deeper. So, I mean, you know, that's a funny example. But I do think that slowness is very powerful in music because it makes you ask questions about where is this music, you know, where is this song going? Where is it taking me? You know, how long is it going to take? It makes you think about your own sense of passing time and, you know, then inevitably into bigger questions about life and death.
Talking to Ben Ratliff, music writer for the New York Times, and his new book, Every Song Ever, he's suggesting some organizing principles to expand our musical horizons in a way in a world of almost infinite music. Let's get to another organizing principle, and we'll start out with Duke Ellington to introduce the concept of repetition. Track is Reminiscing in Tempo by Duke Ellington. And Ben, talk about repetition as a way to organize our listening.
Well, repetition, there's different kinds of repetition in music, but repetition, you know, good repetition in music, really effective repetition, is sort of like, it's the idea of slight changes against a constant. You know, if we in a song, if we heard exactly the same thing over and over, the same phrase, like identical over and over, I don't think that we would like it very much. When we talk about, you know, repetition as a positive thing, we're talking about something that changes slowly as it moves along, but it gives you the feeling of repetition. And again, it gets into you know, this book is about listening experiences, and it focuses on the human experience of listening and how you can sort of get inside the song and feel the effect of it. So you start to think about the repetition involved in daily life, really. All these chapters in the book, all these different ways of listening to music, are not musical terms per se. You know, like in the old music appreciation books from the first half of the 20th century, music would be broken down into musical ideas. You know, here's a chapter on how melody works. Here's a chapter on how harmony works, etc. What I'm doing is I'm assuming that, you know, now the listener is more powerful. We can take listening experiences as the jumping off place.
And we're going to go out with one that you recommend for the category of the perfect moment, a moment of perfect authenticity and surprise. A little surprise. I think it's probably the first time we played it on Central Time. This is God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols. Ben Ratliff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Ben Ratliff is a jazz and pop critic for the New York Times, the author of several books, including Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty.